Divorce can be contentious, especially when it comes to child custody arrangements and the splitting of financial assets. Life moves on, new relationships are formed, new children are born. But what if one party cannot let things go? On the surface, it seems to be about money. But what if it goes much deeper than that? A twisted version of reality caused by mental illness, perhaps? No matter how wronged an ex-spouse may feel, it's rather unusual to resort to using a bomb to settle the matter. Even more unusual, it takes 18 years to achieve justice for the victim. This is the case of Gary Triano, and this is Murder Me on Monday.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Murder Me on Monday podcast. I'm Cameron, and as always, joined with me is Mother.
Hello. Very quick update for you all. Lots of things have been happening with the Visine Jessica Kowski case. Yet another lot of lawyers have gone. The judge is giving new ones time to get up to date. Minor drama, but if it keeps up, we may end up doing a midweek update drop. So make sure you have hit that subscribe button on whatever app you use. This week's case. It did hit the news cycles when it happened, but it was a blink and miss it type of event in the UK, I think. I certainly don't remember it. There was a lot going on with a certain newborn son at the time.
Is that a dig at me for missing this? Sorry that I was born. I had very little to do with that, actually.
Yeah, it's one of those things I just realised. You're probably about 4 months old when this happened. It became a huge case eventually. Lots of very big shows like Dateline and 48 Hours plus others covered it, along with dozens and dozens of videos on YouTube.
Was that isolated to America, though? Because you said it was still a small case in the UK.
Yes.
Blink and miss it.
Yeah.
And again, not my fault for that, by the way.
No.
4 months old, couldn't do much with a baby.
There is also a book called A Socialite Scorned. I have read some of it. Let's just say the detail I wanted was missing. To be honest, the missing details is the same in almost all the reports, which is frustrating. And we're not here to review documentaries, so a lot of what I have comes from court records. There are a lot of theories still out there on the victim, the killers, and possibly mob connections. Although we will discuss some of the allegations, they are unsubstantiated and won't hold up in court and have been denied by other family members. There will be some backwards and forwards with the characters, and I have omitted some names of minor players as I also struggled to build a picture in my head of everyone, let alone Cameron trying to follow along. Let us start with Gary. Born on the 6th of November 1943 in Sacramento, California. Know nothing about his parents. Doesn't appear to have any siblings, no mention of extended family. When and how the family moved to Tucson, Arizona, I don't know, but that is where Gary went to school and to university. Tucson is almost 900 miles from Sacramento. Sits about an hour from the Mexican border in the middle of a desert, covers about 250 square miles with a population of over 500,000. One miscellaneous fact for you. Arizona doesn't do what Americans call daylight savings time. So I'll moan about British summer time to Greenwich Mean Time and then back again. Doesn't happen for them. I've got no idea why. I know some states don't do it.
No one really wants it. Farmers don't want it either.
No. It was there for the war. And that's been over for...
Was that to increase production during the time?
Yes.
Okay, because people blame it on farmers and they don't want it either.
No,
it makes
was...
no difference to them.
Yeah, that was the original reasoning for doing it. I'm not going to tell everybody how old I am, but I remember as a child, 6 or 7 years old, being told, oh, yes, it will be changed and we'll go back to sticking to GMT. But no, we don't.
A little thing for people. The day that we lose an hour, heart attacks go up by about 25%. And the day that we gain an hour, they go down by about the same amount. So lack of sleep will kill you.
Gary gets a degree in accounting. Also ends up attending a law school. I don't know if he qualified in anything. But it probably helped him set up, where he goes on to become what is euphemistically described as a multi-millionaire real estate developer. Sometimes property mogul. America, the land of opportunity. Well, It certainly smiled on Gary. There is nothing in his background to suggest his family roots come from money, but he certainly lived the high life along with his wife and two children. Very big mansion, the cars, the expensive holidays, all the good stuff. How he funded it seems to have been the problem. I am actually in awe of how many pies this man seems to have stuck his fingers in. He tries at running for public office more than once, I think. Some shenanigans too, which kind of sets the tone. Buying property or land or even businesses with loans. Selling and keeping the profits, but not paying back the loans. That was a frequent thing. Yet he always got away with it, despite the multiple legal cases against him.
It's probably handy being a lawyer yourself. You're going to know the bare minimum or even the maximum to get away with it and write it into your contracts. So there's weird little ways.
Yeah, I see things.
You can have work done, then never have to pay it back because of this reason. After a certain time, can't be collected on.
Yeah.
When you said that he had made a lot of money, but you don't know how he got the money and how he was affording to fund it all, it was giving Ponzi scheme vibes at the beginning.
Yes, very much so. He also set up some sort of deal with a local indigenous tribe to run casinos on their land, more specifically bingo games. Using a name for the brand, the tribe had decided was an offensive slur years ago. That deal, on the surface, brought in almost $800,000 a year, except it didn't. The tribe didn't like the way things were going and pushed Gary and his partner out, and more lawsuits ensued. But I'm skipping ahead a bit. Gary met Pamela Ann Phillips at one of these flashy industry events and was absolutely smitten. She was in the same business, real estate, and they probably bonded over that, and a love of the good life. So enamoured was he with this Southern Belle socialite, within 6 months of first meeting her, he rang his wife, who was on holiday with her two children in Europe, and told her they were getting divorced and he was marrying Pamela. I doubt it was easy for Gary's first wife, overseas and the rug pulled just like that, but she seems to have been far more graceful than many would have in such circumstances.
You say you feel bad for her. When they got together, he wouldn't have had money, would he?
No.
And he developed it when being with her, which means she's entitled to a shitload of money when they get divorced.
I'll get into that.
Well, she should be. Yeah. Again, being a lawyer, he might have fucked with it a little bit, but it's the deficit or the delta in between when you start poor, make money, half of it's entitled to you because you built it together. That's the idea.
Does often become very contentious in some divorces, yeah. They divorce. She gets something like almost $2 million. Or should have. I'll get to that.
Is this the 60s, 70s?
This is in the early 90s. No, late 80s, sorry. And she gets a house and primary custody of the children. And life went on. Gary and Pamela marry on a big old fancy yacht in San Diego, California, on the 4th of October, 1986. And no doubt Pamela thought she had hit the jackpot with this good-looking multimillionaire being able to give her the life she felt she deserved.
Isn't Pamela supposed to have had her own money, though?
She does, but she doesn't have what she thinks Gary has. And it's her money, remember?
Yeah, why spend your own when someone else can do it for you?
Yeah. Pamela, at the time, did not know about the 76 lawsuits Gary had against him for all his dealings that were not strictly good practice or above board. Gary, however, had also married someone who also wasn't completely honest. Pamela was no Southern Belle. She was no socialite. She had been a model, yes. She'd done very well as a real estate agent. Think of the TV show Selling Sunsets. She really looked the part, which no doubt helped. She is frequently described as using her charms and wiles to flatter clients. Then you have her almost shark-like, cold and calculating when it came to commissions. If you served a purpose for her, she loved you. If she had no use for you, she had no interest in you. She's very Marmite, as we Brits would say. She had come from a very poor background. Her father was a single parent and they struggled. There is almost nothing out there about her background. It's hard to separate fiction and fact. She did very well for herself. Married a prominent attorney in Tucson until he got cancer and she promptly divorced him. We can speculate if she didn't want to be a nursemaid, if she had never loved him. I simply do not know. You know the figures you hear of a spouse leaving when the in sickness part of the vows hits, Cameron? Lots of figures I've seen, but no source data. So I was reading up on that. And from a 2015 report of 2,701 marriages, only 6% ended in divorce in the case of illness. But another report from 2009 showed that men were 7 times more likely to leave in sickness. That was specifically around brain cancer. It's all linked as usual.
Do you have any ideas as to why? Because I have a pretty good one. I've discussed this before, not with you specifically, but do you have an idea?
No. Well, I do, but I want to hear you.
Traditionally, in a relationship, and this is going back to traditional, this isn't something that I might prescribe myself, but traditionally, especially even actually at the time that this was happening, but anyway, you said in like the 2000s, the men are the ones that generally go out and earn the money, and women are generally the ones that look after the kids and take care of the house.
Yep.
Just how a lot of people like to live, whether or not you agree with it, what, it doesn't matter. But when a woman is sick and she can't then perform the duties that is sort of pre-confirmed in the relationship, the man goes, well, I'm not getting the part that I want here. I know it's meant to be in sickness and in health and shit, but you ain't doing the washing up, love, and they leave.
Yeah.
Which obviously isn't the good thing. That's generally what it is. If a woman isn't providing what they think they need from it, they'll just piss off. Whereas a woman, probably, if the husband's sick, they're going to be like, yeah, but I love the husband, so I'm going to stay with them. Even though they can't do the traditional, that's in air quotes that you can't see, they're not doing the traditional role, they'll still stay with them.
Yeah, that's exactly where I believe it is. It's a very emotive subject.
Cancer is a really common one as well. I think you said brain cancer, but it's common with cancer as a whole.
Yeah.
Because if you're going through chemo or something, your body is ravaged, you can't do stuff. And the man won't pick up the difference and start doing the chores around the house.
No. Nevertheless, that is exactly what Pamela did. She walked. No idea if there was a prenup or how big a payout she got. She must have gotten something. Modelling can be lucrative, as can real estate, because Pamela built up quite a nest egg. Because she had to use it when Gary's businesses started to crumble and his dodgy dealings caught up with him. I have seen figures bandied about of something around $2 million Pamela gave to Gary to keep him afloat. That Indian bingo deal had long gone. By this time, Pamela and Gary also had 2 children. According to the book I mentioned, Pamela says that Gary didn't want her to work, didn't befit the wife of such a prominent mogul to do so. He also didn't care about money so much as status and appearances. He would obtain whatever he wanted whenever he wanted it. Property, cars, flashy dinners and clothes, and no thought to how it would all be paid for. They were really high rollers, these two. Often socialised, being seen at the places to be, and many photographs of them out there with Donald Trump in his Marla Maples era.
They both are seemingly into things rather than people.
Yes.
It's all about money, what I can buy with it, status, and the money's just a proxy to get it. Same with her.
Yeah.
That's why she can leave the first lawyer easily, or attorney, wherever he was.
Yeah.
It's easy for that to happen. Whereas if you have someone that's interested in people, which is usually the women, that are more interested in people, they tend to go quite well because one can sort of cover for the other. But if they're both interested in stuff and then there's no more stuff, then there's no more relationship.
Exactly right.
And it sounds like there's going to be no more stuff.
Mm. In the book I mentioned, there is some weird take on how much Pamela wanted to be like Marla Maples. But she was brassy in looks compared to Marla. Sort of Marla was exquisite crystal and Pamela was Dollar Tree glass. According to that same book, Pamela says Gary had, by this point, become very physically abusive towards her. I'm going to say it straight up. This accusation is from Pamela. That book's author says that they went through some rooms of police papers, evidence, something like 11,000 emails between the subsequent suspects, statements, police reports. I can't tell if there were any police reports made by Pamela about the assaults. I know there were statements made at the inevitable divorce that happened in 1993. At this point, I'm going to say that Gary's children from his first marriage say he was never less than a good father to them. No abuse. I don't think his ex-wife has ever spoken on the record, and her later behaviour seems to indicate that she too had nothing bad to say about Gary. Gary may have been a lot of things, but daft wasn't one of them. When the divorce was filed, he also filed for what's called Chapter 11 bankruptcy, claiming he had debts of $40 million. That's stupid money, isn't it? Bankruptcy in the USA is very different to the UK. There are multiple different chapters for different circumstances. Chapter 11 is business and private, but usually used by companies. Chapter 11 is about reorganising finances for a business under the eyes of a court. Chapter 13 is the same thing, but for individuals. Chapter 7, which is often spoken about in the press, is about the process of a liquidation bankruptcy, usually for private individuals. So it's trying to keep the company going while the court watches and says, yes, you're allowed to do that. No, you can't. Things like that. So basically, Gary is trying to stop his companies going under and give himself time. What actually happens to that, I don't know. It can take years to get it all finalised. I don't know, but I imagine Pamela would have looked at that as a type of hiding of assets, perhaps? Trying to get out of paying her back what he owed her, maybe? The divorce happens after a huge amount of fighting. Gary is ordered to pay Pamela maintenance, presumably for the children. And Pamela and the children up and move to Aspen, Colorado, over 800 miles from Tucson. Why Aspen? Why so far? One could think it was about keeping the children away from their father, which is probable. Pamela is nothing if not vindictive. If you are cynical, like me, well, it's Aspen, the playground of the rich and famous. On the hunt for husband number three, maybe? Pamela goes back into real estate. She also picks up a boyfriend that becomes a business mentor to her, but he wasn't her usual type at all. Ronald Young, described by many as a small-time crook. He was no wheeler dealer for sure. He was also not going to set any records as businessman of the year. He was actually Pamela's new neighbour. And the mentoring? He helped her develop a website. He's also no oil painting in his later pictures. He may have possessed film star looks back in 1993, for all I know. Pamela, again, places much value on appearances. And, predictably, Pamela and Gary continue to fight. Custody of the children, visitation, not remotely surprised at that, and the child support. It's even said that Gary's first wife, who possibly came after this mess slightly less financially scathed, was paying Gary's child support to Pamela to keep her off his back. And Gary was really on his uppers and sharing a house with a friend. If Gary had ever been abusive to his first wife and children, been less than a nice person, can you imagine she would pay his payments for him? Possibly not. Anyway. And as far as Gary being on his uppers, well, he was a bit. He was sharing a house, even driving cars people loaned him, but he wasn't entirely down and out. Still had a way with the women, got into another relationship, and even had a child with a much younger woman. That relationship didn't end well. Gary refused to marry her. You can't blame him. He doesn't have a good track record. There's talk about one incident where she lobbed a glass vase at Gary's head in the garage. There are even more court cases involving that girlfriend and deals and how they were connected to Gary's dealings. And frankly, it's confusing and hard to tell if it's even relevant, other than these people's lives are full of drama. It's exhausting. Gary also still had his country club membership. even though he couldn't pay the membership fees and would soon become an ex-member. They were going to kick him out within about 2 weeks. And so it was on the 1st of November 1996, Gary had just finished bashing a few balls around on the golf course at La Paloma Country Club in the Catalina foothills, just north of Tucson, and made his way back to his borrowed car. I think the days of him dropping bets of $10,000 on the outcome of a match were long gone. Gary had fun. He chatted to people in the car park as he was about to leave. He was heading off to celebrate his 53rd birthday early with friends. The party may or may not have been a surprise for Gary. What happened next certainly was. No one batted an eyelid at Gary getting into a burgundy 1989 Lincoln Town Car until the plume of smoke rose and windows in the country club blew out from the explosion at 5:38 p.m. Gary was likely killed instantly, and lots of people were injured and traumatised by either witnessing the explosion or just by being in the vicinity as glass showered down as the windows of the club shattered and parts of the car landed in the club's outdoor swimming pool, along with parts of Gary's right hand.
I was going to ask you a question, but then I pictured Gary's hand landing in the pool and I got distracted. He drove the car to the country club.
Yes.
So
I will explain.
I'm assuming it was planted whilst he was, or something. It's a bomb, obviously. It didn't just fucking go off by itself. No. There was a bomb or something was planted when he was at the country club. So did the I'm asking questions that you're going to answer or would have naturally gone to say anyway, but I'm asking you because I can look at your face. Carry on.
You're not wrong. Let's say that. 5:40 p.m., so 2 minutes after that explosion, there was a cardiologist socialising with friends at the club who ran towards...
He's like, yeah, that's a hand, he's dead. Okay, yeah, he's fucked. Where's the rest of him?
He ran towards the explosion and checked Gary immediately, and he was dead.
Gary got turned into a pink mist. Like,
Not quite, but yeah. Obviously, local police arrive. The ATF is also called. No one knows at that time why the car blew up. And if it's a bomb, what if there are others? Gary's body is left in the car for 7 hours until the county medical examiner managed to get there. He would have to be the one to declare Gary dead and he couldn't be moved until then. And that bothered me.
Well, they're probably worried about another bomb, though.
Yeah, but... waiting 7 hours for an ME, I can understand that. You know, get all the little robots under the cars and make sure nothing else is there. But there should have been a deputy on standby. The ME didn't turn up for 7 hours. It was odd.
What's the consequences of that, though? Is it just declaring time of death? Or is that to see if Gary is alive?
No, declare time of death.
Isn't that just like a...
I know.
Like a semantic thing or paperwork thing?
Yes, it is. It absolutely is, but it's one of those rules. Some places are much stricter than
others.
Yeah,
only certain people can't even declare it, so it can be days before they're legally declared dead. Yeah.
There is a lot of flowery language in books and reports. Presumptions of what actually happened. Emotions Gary felt. None of this is fact. There was an eyewitness sat in another vehicle parked next to Gary's car.
Wait.
Yes.
I had a thought. A bomb was planted in the car. Well, he borrowed it from someone, didn't he?
Yes.
Could also be, I don't know if other people have thought about this, like a mistaken identity kind of thing. Probably not, but I'm just putting that out there. It could be. It's not your car.
It could have been. Could have been a really unfortunate set of circumstances if it had been meant for somebody else. But no, it wasn't. Anyway. That eyewitness is sat in the car and they're actually reading a magazine. I knew this. They saw a person stood next to Gary's car. That person was later discounted as part of the investigation. That's out. Nowhere does it state that the eyewitness watched Gary get into the car, nor did it state that they seem to have watched Gary turn to a blue hold-all type bag sat on the passenger seat, nor did they see him brush his hand gently across the box showing just inside the unzipped hold-all. Nor does it state that Gary thought it was an early birthday present from his friends. These are all assumptions. It's absolutely impossible to know what Gary thought. Yet that flowery language is out there in multiple news reports. Some podcasts I loved back in the day often use such language, ascribing thoughts and emotions and actions that were simply made up.
Is it how they frame it by saying this is what was felt versus this is what I think they'd feel?
No, they
say this is what is felt. I'm saying the way that I try to frame things is this is what I think about the situation, not what the situation is. I'm assuming theirs is, oh, he felt this way. He knew it was a present. Kaboom.
Yes, yes, that's exactly what it is. It makes good fiction, but it's poor factual retelling. Gary did, however, have a habit of leaving his car unlocked. It is possible he thought it was a gift, but no wrapping paper in sight that we know of.
I guess so. If he's with high society and a lot of money, you're probably not concerned about your car being stolen. But if I was a car thief, I'm going to want to try to target that more. But they're probably less successful because of security and people working there.
Yeah.
So if you're at a country club, you don't lock your door. Probably safer than just doing it on the street.
Yeah. It's also possible that Gary thumped the bag or box or shook it. We simply do not know why the bag containing what was later said to be a pipe bomb blew up when it did. Tumble switch, timer, remote detonation. Again, suspicious cars leaving the car park. Tatty cars. Instantly, ooh, that's the guy. They were all discounted. I'm not getting into pipe bombs again after last time, except to say they've been around and used for assassinations at least since the late 1800s. I think this is the third case with bombs, isn't it, Cameron?
I don't know. Every time there's a bomb involved, I say the IRA and you get funny. So I'm not allowed to discuss them.
Episode 18 was the neck bomb thing. Brian
Episode
Wells.
Episode 18?
Yeah, 18.
That's going back about 2 years. I don't remember that.
And then we
I do remember that, actually, I think.
Yeah?
Yeah, I do remember that one because it was... There was like a harness around his neck, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Pizza deliveries. Episode 25, David Copeland. They were the London bombings. There may be more. My records are not that good on the method. Maybe I ought to capture that going forward. I don't know. Let us talk about the autopsy briefly. It took 9.5 hours. After watching Dr. G do it in less than 30 minutes, I'm a little less than impressed.
Yeah, but that defined the rest of Gary.
This is true.
Some of him was in a tree.
It's in the swimming pool. They actually do bring him along in bags. Gary was 6'2", about 240 pounds. So just over 17 stone or roughly 108, 109 kilos. Gary's skin on his skull was sliced open, leaving visible bone. It was about 4 inch long and 1 inch wide. Metal from the pipe bomb was embedded in his brain. His hair was singed. His eyes were ruptured. His right hand, except for his little finger, was blown off, and that's the bit that was found in the swimming pool. Gary's right arm was broken above the elbow, and a blast had split his abdomen and severely lacerated his liver. He basically bled out, but he also died from shock. ATF and the local police did not get along. Police wanted to put pictures out of the bag, asking if anyone had sold one like it. ATF refused to allow that. There were arguments about the language the ATF used, saying black powder, but not mentioning a pipe bomb, and so on. It was jurisdictional pissing contest, really. The press were going, ooh, mob hit, because Gary did know some very shady characters and had some very shady dealings, and the mob is a thing in Tucson. But there was simply no evidence when police went looking. Gary had a huge list of people who disliked, even hated him. He also had a huge list of people who loved him, had nothing to say except good things about him. A very, very complex character, and obviously made investigating even harder. Of course, the contentious divorce made them look at Pamela. Eyebrows were raised when they found out that Pamela had taken out a $2 million life insurance policy on Gary just a few months before his murder. The beneficiaries, however, were their children. There are ways and means around that little inconvenience, however, but there doesn't appear to have been anything major shady. and Pamela waited 3 months to collect on that policy. That was possibly a smart move. Authorities look harder at Pamela and her associates when the leads into Gary's possible business dealings didn't bear fruit. And that led them to Ronald Young, the neighbour, mentor, boyfriend, whatever he was. It turned out in April of 1996, so 7 months or so before Gary was murdered, Ronald had been reported to police for fraud by two businessmen in Aspen. About the same time, Pamela's lawyer had also reported Ronald to the police for fraud on behalf of Pamela. Why she didn't do that in person, I've got no idea. Grandeur, maybe? Yet a couple of weeks later, Pamela said she wanted no part of the investigation, and so it was dropped with her case, but not for the other complaints by the businessmen. Police get an arrest warrant, so there must have been enough evidence. But Ronald had left town in a rented van and failed to return it. Another crime to be added, as in the July, the rental company reported it as stolen. Yet Ronald was staying at a motel near to Gary's place in Tucson, using an assumed name. And he was still in contact with Pamela, seemingly still boyfriend and girlfriend, even though she had tried to stick fraud charges on him. In the October of 1996, police in California found the van. No sign of Ronald. Obviously, it's Aspen police that want the van because it's stolen. And a detective is actually sent from Aspen, 800 miles away, to look at the van. I did wonder at that until you think about those fraud charges. They must have been something impressive to bother sending someone so far for a stolen van rather than tell the rental company, come and get it. Inside that van, they find a shotgun and ammunition, an Arizona license plate, a Tucson map, paperwork with Ronald's name on it. There are also lists in Ronald's handwriting of Gary's friends and family, the cars they drove, and where they worked.
It's like having a picture of him with a big red circle and a cross in it.
Or stalker, yeah.
No, the shotgun and ammunition, that's beyond a stalker.
Well, the van also contained paperwork regarding Pamela's divorce from Gary. Also documents showing Ronald's May 1996 purchase of an airplane ticket for Pamela to fly from Aspen to Denver and back, and bills for a stay at a Tucson hotel near Gary's home in July of 96. So I was back to the maps at this point. Tucson has an airport. So where did Denver come into it? Denver's only about 200 miles from Aspen. So it was a strange flight to me, although I know it's sometimes easier to fly in the USA than use a train or drive. I'm baffled, so turn back to the court records. That's October of 1996. Police find out about Gary being murdered in the November. And then knowing Gary's ex-wife Pamela and Ronald are connected, they turn this stuff over to the Tucson police. I still don't know what Denver had to do with any of it. It goes silent until 2005, 9 years later. The UK has, or did have, Crime Watch, which got cancelled. America has America's Most Wanted. It's been cancelled and revived many times, and it's still going. That show was on TV in 2005, and Ronald was on it. There was a tip. He gets picked up in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for the fraud. But before he can be shipped back to Aspen, he ends up serving 10 months in a Florida federal prison on weapons charges. Authorities may not be able to get to Pamela directly, but they can use what they find when they arrest Ronald to tie them back together. He has a hotel room, a storage unit, and a laptop, which is a gold mine. They discover that Pamela had been sending Ronald money this whole time. Apparently, Ronald kept what was called an amortization schedule on there. So the likes of him, you and me, It's basically a spreadsheet used to calculate or estimate your monthly and total payments for a loan amount, the term, the interest rate, and start date. It showed a debt starting at $400,000. So I was, what debt? Who? Police bring in the big guns, forensic accountants. The accountant found the loan schedules were consistent with payments Pamela had been making to Ronald beginning in early 1997. That was when Pamela got the life insurance payout on Gary. I said there were ways around it being for the children, didn't I? Pamela carried on paying Ronald until late 2004, early 2005. The accountant also concluded the two had attempted to conceal the transactions. So, by that timeline, Pamela had stopped paying Ronald, which maybe explains what he does next. Insurance policy for him, yes, but also all kinds of stupid. Ronald started recording telephone calls he had with Pamela. These recordings show that they referred to their financial dealings explicitly and implicitly as an illegal arrangement, and Pamela was worried about being caught. During one call, Ronald told Pamela he needed to remind her that he had helped her with something that was beyond what anybody else in the world would probably do, and that she was living off the benefits of it. Why they have not actually said what it was, it's not hard to work out. They just needed a bit more evidence.
Ronald shaping up to be the smartest one out of this whole story so far. He's recording the phone call between him and Pamela.
Yeah. And he's been on the run for just 8 years, and she's been paying him the whole time. So he's been living
as high a life as he can, but he's recording it because, yeah, like, look, she's incriminating herself and admitting to stuff. Look, yeah, it wasn't all me.
Yeah. There was another recorded call when they disagreed about how much Pamela owed Ronald, and he warned her that she would be in prison for murder. No idea what her response to that was. October 2008, Ronald and Pamela are charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. Pamela was in Vienna in Austria. The children she had with Gary, both boys, I believe, were adults by this time, and very probably not with her. I assume she must have had access to money, probably that insurance money, because she stays put. You want me, you come and get me, kind of thing.
By this point, would she have owned any property?
Probably not, no. Why she was in Vienna, we don't know.
I was wondering about income sources, because her relying on a bank of money, a stockpile, isn't good enough, especially if she's running through it quickly.
Presumably, they would have been able to freeze her USA bank account. So maybe she did have money in Austria, or maybe she was living off somebody else over there again. She's,
true.
She's, yeah, got a history of it, hasn't she? Ronald goes to trial in 2010. I can't find anything on that trial except mention of, in addition to what evidence I've already told you about, that there was a jailhouse informant that also testified against Ronald, saying that Ronald had admitted to killing Gary. Regardless of what the jury thought of that snitch, the prosecution case and the motive of that $2 million life insurance policy won them over, and Ronald ends up with two consecutive life sentences. Appeal 1, 2012, gets him reduced down to 25 years and the possibility of parole on one sentence. Appeal 2 goes nowhere in 2017. After Ronald is tried, Pamela is extradited back to Tucson in 2011. Very interestingly, Pamela is then declared mentally incompetent to stand trial.
Is that something she chased? Because we're on, what, episode 139?
Yeah.
And about 138 of them, people have tried to get declared medically or mentally unfit to stand trial. She's done it. Is that by her choice or not?
I don't believe it was. She's...
one of the genuine ones. Okay.
Well, she's very strange. She's shipped off to be restored to competency, as it's known. I think it's one of these states that doesn't allow you to plead, you know, insanity.
Would they keep her in the care of the state until she is then fit to serve trial? Until but she's... if someone doesn't return, they're there indefinitely.
Yes, that's exactly yeah. what the Lori Vallow case has been.
That's where I think I've got the memory of it from.
Yeah. That takes until 2012, but I don't think they did a thorough job, if I'm honest. But anyway, I try to dig into this incompetency statement. And apparently, she was complaining that someone had been watching and listening to her for the past 7 to 8 years. And she believed that she had tracking devices placed in her neck and in her passport. She also said that she had somehow or another had plugs inserted into her brain, which allowed people to both track her and control her body, and had described feelings as though waves of energy or electricity had flowed through her body at times. At other times, she feels like she's exploding or imploding. I'm okay at this point. I know what it sounds like to me, maybe a mishmash of a few different disorders. Obviously not an expert, but let's embrace the tech. I went looking for and found a medical version of ChatGPT. I plugged all that in, and after the caveats of not for medical diagnoses, etc., I got... the complaints described suggest the presence of delusions, specifically paranoid delusions and somatic delusions. These symptoms may be indicative of a psychotic disorder such as schizophrenia or a delusional disorder. It is important for the individual to seek comprehensive psychiatric evaluation, blah, blah, blah. So that then led me to look up what the heck somatic delusions were. And I got... a somatic delusion is a false belief that a person's internal or external bodily functions are abnormal. This belief may also extend to viewing one's physical appearance as very irregular. It can go hand in hand with schizophrenia, delirium, bipolar.
It sounds a bit like body dysmorphia cranked up to 12.
Yeah. Her mannerisms when she's in court, when she talks, she's not running on all cylinders. There's no way.
She's probably had decades of drug abuse as well.
Very good point.
The cocaine's eating her brain away.
Yeah. So she's restored, as they say, but when her trial starts in 2014, they say she's off. That trial lasted 7 weeks. It's not all day, every day. There are lots of legal arguments, lawyers getting removed, Pamela being weird in court. 1 minute, the Southern Belle, again, full of charm. The next, cold and calculating. And then you get these weird moments. Very strange facial expressions. Lots of the same evidence that was in Ronald's trial, with a few attempts at people on her side claiming it was the mob again. And there's also one rather unfortunate claim that a local billionaire, who was himself rather volcanic in nature, gets dragged into it. Seems at one point, Gary, short on funds, tried to sell Pamela's engagement ring to the guy, claiming it was worth $250,000. That's a drop in the ocean for these people, but Gary needed funds. The stone was fake. The billionaire goes into orbit and everyone blames him for having Gary killed. Conveniently for Pamela, the guy had died before the trial, so couldn't even defend himself. Although, obviously, the family put out a statement saying, a pack of lies. I know people with this kind of money, these kind of circles, are not going into a pawn shop. So it's possible that Gary did try and sell it to him. I don't know that that story is still widely believed, as is the mob angle. Gary's name was on a hit list. That claim came up again in Pamela's trial, along with revelations about how much money Gary owed around town. $2 or $3 million at casinos, and still owed, apparently, $1.8 million to his first wife. That made me sad for her and the children. With Gary gone, she'll never collect, and her paying Gary's maintenance, which was something silly like $1,100 a month to stop Pamela having him slung in jail for non-payment, just seems like another kick in the teeth. Anyway, Pamela is convicted, gets the same two life sentences as Ronald, and then we go into appeals. The one from 2018 is interesting on the claims of lack of discovery. Stuff the prosecution didn't reveal and that outside agencies didn't hand over, like the ATF, I would suspect, and the FBI. There are a lot of outside agencies. Her lawyers had been given 300,000 pages or 160 boxes of information, but they were only given an additional 2,000 pages a month before the trial. That's not a lot of information to go through in a month, but maybe it could have turned things on its head until you read further. Pamela, or rather her lawyers, conceded that some of the information obtained from federal agencies was, or contained, information that Pamela had independently discovered years before. That information apparently connected various individuals to other individuals and entities, and you're going back into this mob angle. It didn't mean that the court had erred. And she even used this information in her trial that had only turned up the month before. Yet in her appeal, she said, I didn't have enough time to use it, which is. So they stuffed up their own appeal on that point. I'll link the appeal if you enjoy reading that stuff, as it will have you shaking your head. It did have me thinking that there's a whole lot more to this case. Is it convenient to blame Pamela and Ronald? Of course. Is it possible that somebody else may have done it? Yes. Is it probable? No. There are other books out there than the one I've read, all the TV shows. There are dozens and dozens of videos on YouTube and even a lot of podcasts. Everyone has an opinion, and I did struggle to find something that wasn't angled one way or the other. And the mob links? I'm not going there. Just not my cup of tea at all. I don't think that Pamela and Gary's children have ever spoken about this either. Not that I blame them. And that fifth child that he had with the girlfriend after the divorce, hopefully that child is being raised in anonymity too. I have to say, Gary's find a grave site was intriguing. Just how bare of information it was. Two lines. No obituary. No background on him. There was a link to what appears to be his father, who passed in 1983. Nothing for any other relatives. But it was the amount of memorial flowers left virtually on the site. 55. I've not seen that number for a non-celebrity before. Very odd. I think people who knew everyone involved in this will always have suspicions. Gary may have been shady, but he had people who did love him and care for him. And yet again, it was very probably all about money. If not Pamela and Ronald for the insurance, then other people that were owed money.
I'm sure I'm not the only one that doesn't feel overly sympathetic towards Gary, and my attitude's a bit more tongue-in-cheek than normal. I refer to him as being pink-misted when the car blew up. It's because I don't think he's a particularly nice person. That obviously doesn't mean he deserved to die, but if you told me that he's the one that planted a pipe bomb for Pamela, I wouldn't have been surprised.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think any of them are particularly nice people.
It sounds like a bunch of narcissists that have killed each other.
Yes.
So when it happens, you're like, well, the victim wasn't particularly nice, so I don't feel that bad. It's not like it's a mother of two that was just standing at a bus stop that got killed.
Yeah.
A completely innocent person, but he doesn't seem particularly moral or ethical in most of his actions. I'm a bit like, well, it's sad that he died and he had kids, but at the same time, I'm like, well, he did. He's not a nice person.
76 cases, I think, he had against him. That's 76 companies or individuals or, you know, county lawyers or whatever. He's done something that they felt that he...
Oh, yeah, but even if it was 1,000, I don't think that warrants being murdered. But I'm saying when it's happened, I'm not overly sad that it has happened.
What I meant was his ability to stitch people up. that enough that you've got 76.
Yeah.
I know big corporations, you know, telephone companies and that, will equally have that amount of cases against them, but they are large corporations.
Not an individual. It's a bit of an appeal to populace that a lot of people are doing it, therefore you kind of side with them, because if it was an instance of one person complaining, you think, oh, that's one person. When there's 1,000, you think there might be something to it.
Yes.
But that's also a fallacy, because that doesn't mean any of them are right. The merit has to be assessed individually.
Yeah.
So just because 76 people have tried to sue him, I'm like, eh, well, it kind of makes you feel a certain kind of way that's probably true.
Some of the links that I've posted will take you into much greater depth with regard to the mob angle, with regard to his shady business dealings, with regard to the Indian reservation and how he managed to piss them off, which is incredibly unusual. They just didn't want to pay him anymore because they didn't think he was value for money, and they would rather have given the jobs to their own people. And he wasn't having any of it, and it got very ugly.
Very quickly. Yeah.
Very quickly. So, and that is the end of this week's episode. And even though he might not have been the best guy in the world, finally the victim who should not be forgotten. Gary Lee Triano, aged 52.
Oh, and that is the end of the episode. Thank you so much for listening. Clearly you enjoyed it so much, you're going to go subscribe to us over on Patreon. You can find it in the description below. You get content a week early, exclusive content, and extra content at the end of a standard episode. If you want to tell us how much you love us, you can find us over on Instagram and Twitter at Murder Me Monday Podcast. If you're on the Patreon, hang around. You've got the case autopsy coming up. Much love. Peace.
Bye.